So I'm Rachel Treweek. I'm the Bishop of Gloucester, and I'm also one of the Lords Spiritual. And I'm delighted in this podcast to be bringing together some very significant people in the whole field of domestic abuse. We are waiting for the Domestic Abuse Bill to have its second reading in the House of Lords. And in the meantime, there is lots of work and conversation going on behind the scenes. And I'm hoping this podcast will enable us to deepen our understanding and reflect more deeply. So first of all, I'm just going to ask those who are joining me in this conversation to give their name and their role, and then we will continue with this conversation. So let's start with Nicole. If you could just give us your name and your role.
Hi, I'm Nicole Jacobs, and I'm the Designate Domestic Abuse Commissioner for England and Wales.
Thank you. Andrea.
Hello, I'm Andrea Simon and I'm Head of Public Affairs at the End Violence Against Women Coalition.
Thank you. Pragna.
Hi, I'm Pragna and I'm the Director of Southall Black Sisters.
Thank you. Katie.
Hi, I'm Katie Swain-Williams and I work for the Prison Reform Trust.
Thank you. Huda.
Hello, my name is Huda Jawad and I work at Standing Together Against Domestic Abuse and co-founder of the Faith and Walk Coalition.
Thank you. Nikki.
Hi, I'm Nikki Gould, Head of Women's Community Services from the Nelson Trust. We have women's centres supporting women experiencing multiple vulnerabilities and complex needs.
Thank you. And last but not least, Robin.
Hello, I'm Robin Andreo-Buzzi. I'm co-director of IC Change, a campaign for the UK government to ratify the Istanbul Convention on Violence Against Women. And I'm managing, in my day job, the Anglican Diocese of Melbourne's Preventing Violence Against Women programme.
Thank you. So Nicole, I wonder if I could come to you first in your role, just to say a little bit more, and particularly to say one or two comments about this domestic abuse bill.
Yeah, sure. The domestic abuse bill does a lot of things all at once. So it has many moving parts to it. One of which is it embeds my role. So as the Domestic Abuse Commissioner for England and Wales, it's a new role. And this bill gives it a statutory underpinning and some powers, some specific powers to seek information and be able to make recommendations. But beyond that, it creates a definition for domestic abuse that includes children as victims in their own right, includes things like financial abuse or economic abuse as part of domestic abuse. And it also has several kind of criminal justice or family justice remedies to it, which I'm sure we'll speak about. And also, very importantly, it gives a statutory duty for refuge provision or accommodation-based services for domestic abuse. So there's many, many things that could be improved, but it certainly has quite a lot in it so far. And importantly, it also has a statutory guidance that runs alongside the bill that has many, many aspects of our response to domestic abuse or what should be included in our response to domestic abuse. And that will be published with the bill.
Thank you. A really important point there, that as well as the bill, that statutory guidance, which is going to be so significant. So thank you for raising that. And Nicole, you've started there saying some things that are really good, that we're glad about this bill coming in, but also beginning to raise some of the concerns about where there could be improvements. So I'm going to come to Andrea next, I think. Andrea, perhaps you might just comment on what you're pleased about with this bill coming into existence, and perhaps just one or two things where you still have concerns.
I think one of the most significant measures that the bill brings in, or what it introduces, is the Office of the Domestic Abuse Commissioner. So you've heard from Nicole already, and I think that there is a huge potential for the Domestic Abuse Commissioner's Office to improve responses across the board to domestic abuse victims. I think the areas the bill must go a lot further with are ensuring that we have equally effective support for all victims and survivors. So in particular, the most marginalised survivors, be they from Black or minority ethnic communities, migrant backgrounds, LGBT disabled survivors, I think they the bill still lacks measures that will ensure that they can receive the same amount of support and protection as everybody else. We've got quite significant issues with migrant women being able to access refuge provision, and we have a statutory duty to improve the provision of accommodation-based services, but it leaves out very crucial community-based services which victims rely on.
Mm. Thank you, Andrea. And I think that brings me very naturally actually to Pragna, about what you might want to add in there, Pragna.
Well, Andrea touched upon the needs of migrant women in particular. And I think that that is the gaping hole, the real hole in the bill. It is a bill that's been lauded as a once in a generation or once in a landmark, you know, a landmark bill that is meant to provide the kind of solid foundations for safety and protection for all women. But you can't have a bill that leaves some women out. And that is a serious concern. I mean, it is a serious concern, not just because it leaves migrant women out, but as Andrea said, it leaves other marginalized groups out. Mm-hmm. Disabled women, I think, is another area that there's a serious concern about the lack of attention to the needs of disabled women. But coming back to migrant women, what is particularly ironic about this bill is that there are measures in there that are good. You know, Nicole's kind of outlined those, and Andrea, you know, the access to refuge, better access to family justice system, better access to the criminal justice system. And yet none of these measures will apply to migrant women. Not one. Not one. And it seems to me that that is the concern, that you have a safety net in which there are many women left out, left behind. We need to see migrant women included, because the bill is meant to be part of, you know, what we often talk about is a really frank, comprehensive discussion about domestic abuse, gender-related violence, how it affects women. And yet the multiple barriers that migrant women face, both in terms of seeking protection when they go to the police or social services or to local authorities for housing, but also in relation to accessing therapeutic services and so on, they're very much just completely left behind. So my concern is that, you know, unless migrant women are in there, we can't really be talking about a bill that protects all women.
Thank you, Pragna. And we'll come back to that in a moment. I wonder if at that point I could bring in Katie of the Prison Reform Trust.
My concern, my work is around people who are involved in offending, and specifically women involved in offending. And we know that nearly 60% of women in prison are victims of domestic abuse. Actually, the figures like to be much higher than that. That's the reported official figures. So my concern around the bill would be, in addition to the other marginalised groups, there's a really a missed opportunity here to extend much better legal protection to victims of domestic abuse whose experience of abuse actually leads them directly into offending. And at the moment, there's very little legal protection in the system to allow those victims to be diverted away from the criminal justice system and into support where appropriate.
Mm. Thank you, Kate. I think that leads me nicely to come to Nikki, working with the Women's Centres, working with the Nelson Trust. Anything you would want to add? Obviously, you're very much dealing with the on-ground experience in the Women's Centres. Anything you've heard that you would want to say, yes, that resonates?
Absolutely. And it's something that I was going to say, actually, that Katie's just said, in that women who come into contact with the criminal justice system often have histories of domestic abuse and previous trauma. And there is a lack of protection for those women. And we see lots of women ending up in prison, even separated from their children, as a result of domestic abuse, where domestic abuse has been the driver for offending. And I would absolutely welcome in the bill an acknowledgement of this and the introduction of a statutory defence for women who have come into contact with the criminal justice system as a consequence of domestic abuse. What I do welcome from the bill is that women fleeing domestic abuse will be considered as priority need. Something we also see a lot is the reason why women don't leave is often because they don't have any choice, because their choice would be to be homeless or to stay in the relationship. And particularly for women who are experiencing complex needs, such as substance misuse, and they're probably misusing substances to cope with the trauma that they're experiencing, actually, they are then excluded from refuge spaces. So I would welcome further housing support provision for women, absolutely. Mm.
Thank you. And Huda, from your experience, what would you want to add or agree with? Might be something else you want to say as you've listened to all of those voices so far.
Yes, I concur with all my sisters and their comments about the work, the merits of the Domestic Abuse Bill and the opportunity it presents for us to really centre the issue of violence against women and girls in UK kind of legal system. You know, obviously we would like a much wider bill that encompasses violence against women and girls generally rather than domestic abuse. And the concern, I guess, for me here is, again, echoing the needs or the lack of access to justice for migrant women, because that what happens is a whole swathe of, you know, women who are the most marginalized will not be able to use any of the, you know, legal measures and protections afforded to other women. But also, I fear that perhaps the Domestic Abuse Bill adopts a very criminal and legal framework which does not speak to the role of the wider society and communities in upholding the right of safety for women, and the role of communities in holding perpetrators to account, but also supporting a much more violent-free life for women in general. And I wonder whether at some point, and perhaps the guidance of the bill will incorporate these voices, because we know that from the consultation of the process, there has been a distinct lack of consultation with communities, whether, you know, faith communities, minoritized communities, or anybody from the kind of general public, is where what is their role in helping end violence against women?
Mm. Thank you, Huda. And I think you touch again on something really important there, which we've discussed, which is about the role of different faith communities in all of this. We know that faith of all different sorts can actually exacerbate violence because of different religious belief and culture. We also know that faith communities can be a great place of helping address these issues and bringing healing and ways forward. And that's something I know that we've discussed, and again, we might pick up again. But that leads really nicely to Robin Boosey, who's actually joining us from Australia, and I think has a lot to share with us, picking up from what Huda was saying about the role of communities. And I'd really like to come to you, Robin, to perhaps just comment on what you've heard. But particularly, I would like to say, what can we learn from Australia?
Thank you. I suppose with my IC Change hat on, one of the things I've been particularly encouraged about in the bill is to see that it includes some of the key, it addresses some of the final hurdles that the government has stated need to be crossed before they'll ratify the Istanbul Convention. So we're pleased to see that that might move us forward towards ratification. And I share the concerns of others and about it not offering protection for all women. And the Istanbul Convention is very clear that governments need to adopt a non-discriminatory approach. So that is a key concern of ours, and we'll be looking to echo, amplify the campaigns around that, around the bill. In terms of from Australia, so I'm British, but I've been working in Australia for the past 2.5 years. And I think there's a lot of learning here about primary prevention and about really going to the root of violence against women and looking at that culture change. So that's something I'm keen to see that how do we go beyond conversations about individuals and individual cases and really look at the broader culture and shifting the norms and attitudes, behaviours and structures that underpin it. There are in the UK, there are initiatives, one-off initiatives on this. The government's starting to name it in policy, but a really deep shift is needed. And in Australia, what you can see is that the government now has a national prevention framework that's evidence-based. They have a national organisation that is driving forward change just in terms of primary prevention and just in terms of that culture change. And I see a huge gap when I look at the UK now and realise that we need to be investing a lot more heavily in this area if we're really serious about stopping violence before it starts.
Thank you. And it'd be good to pick up in perhaps in a few moments some of the key things about that national prevention framework, because I know from conversations with you, I think we could learn a lot here in the UK. And thank you also for mentioning IC Change. For those who are listening, that's the Istanbul Convention. It's what the IC stands for. Nicole, so much in all of that. I'd love just to hear some of your reflections having heard that. And then one thing to let other people begin thinking about is it would be good to bring some snippets of personal stories of people that we know, because we're not just talking about theory here, we are talking about people's lives. But Nicole, while people are thinking about that, what are your reflections as you respond to people?
I think what's interesting listening to the comments, first of all, I agree with all of them wholeheartedly, is thinking about, I think it would surprise most people how our foundation for the work we do in relation to domestic abuse or violence against women and girls in general is not very solid. In other words, the funding that goes into this issue over time, if you think about our first refuges, or the kind of refuge network started there were a few exceptions, but mainly started a little over 40 years ago. We're on a journey in terms of recognizing this as an issue, understanding it well, and the whole range of what domestic abuse means, the whole range of coercion and controlling behaviors, for example. And I think what is really important to know, but most people don't realize unless they're kind of in the situation or trying to help someone in a situation, are all these gaps in our service provision that you've just heard about. Migrant women, services for children, services that are similar from place to place that you could depend on, funding that follows that, services that allow perpetrators to change. Some of the reason why I was appointed to be independent of government, but to hold government to account, is because of what that postcode lottery, which is really true and valid and quite a serious concern. And I think a thread that's running through a lot of these comments are that we have to address that in a much more fundamental way. So right now the bill kind of is seeking to protect refuge provision, which is wonderful as part of the services, but the breadth of provision beyond that could be more vulnerable because of having a statutory duty for refuge. So we have to think about what do we want to see and how is everyone included in terms of the provision we need. So I think that's my main reflection. And that includes people who are involved in the criminal justice system and all of the things we've talked about. And I guess the second point I'd love to make for listeners to appreciate is if there's ever a window to get involved and call a politician, get in contact with your MP, this is definitely it. I mean, we're now nearing the Lord's stage. It's expected that this bill will move quite quickly, and we have high hopes for really great debates about all of these issues in the Lord's, but it is certainly the time to get in touch with government. And I think also just appreciating that this government has a majority, and so they will require pressure in order to really address some of these issues. And so I would just encourage anyone listening that these are you're getting such a lovely kind of array of things that are really needed and really needed to improve this bill. Mm-hmm. And I think we could do it. It's just that we all need to act now. So that those are my key reflections.
Nicole, that's absolutely wonderful. And I would want to say that a number of things people have said connect with amendments that I will certainly be supporting myself in the Lords. And I think that takes us into this being about people's lives. We're not just discussing theory here. And I wonder if we might have, they'll have to be quite short, but some little snippets of where you have experienced this touching people's lives and why you feel passionate about the changes you would like to see. I mean, Nikki, I wonder if I could come to you.
Sure. Obviously, I've mentioned that something that I'm very passionate about is the recognition that women are coming into contact with the criminal justice system who are victims of domestic abuse. And sometimes those women are arrested as the perpetrator of domestic abuse because there may have been an incident of reactive violence, for example. And I have an example of that, actually, of a woman who was arrested about 2 months into lockdown. So we have a point of arrest referral scheme. So essentially, if a woman is arrested and identified as being vulnerable, then she can be referred to Nelson Trust for support. And we received a phone call one day from a custody sergeant, and he told us about a woman who had been arrested as a perpetrator of domestic abuse, but she was very, very distressed, and she didn't have a mobile phone. And she was very scared to return back to her partner. So what we said was, come along to the Women's Centre. Even though we weren't open, a key worker went along to the Women's Centre. And we weren't sure if she was going to turn up or not, but she did turn up. And when she arrived at the Women's Centre, she was absolutely covered in bruises. And she had told us that she had been in a situation where she had been locked in with her partner and experienced horrific sexual and physical violence. And in order to cope with that, she had been drinking a lot of alcohol. She had then retaliated one day. He had called the police and she had ended up in police custody, but she was so terrified to go back. So we needed to try to find her a refuge space. Now, this was very, very difficult because she had been arrested as a perpetrator and also she had been drinking a lot of alcohol. Eventually, we did manage to find her a place in refuge, which was the other side of the country. So we were then trying to access the free train ticket scheme, which again was really difficult to do. We did eventually manage to do it, and a key worker collected her the next day from a friend's house. Luckily, she had a safe place to stay that evening, and she went to refuge, and she has been in refuge since that time. But it just really highlights that during the pandemic, there have been so many women trapped in houses with violent perpetrators with very little opportunity to reach out for that support.
Thank you, Nikki. A really good personal and painful example.
As a frontline organisation, there is nothing that is more frustrating for us than to find that when women turn up at our door, and many of the women we're talking about literally walk in through our doors because they're in a crisis situation, an emergency situation, and to find that because of their lack of immigration status, the lack of settlement and rights in this country, we have no option. We have very few options in terms of what to do to support women. And many of those women come to us feeling, you know, they present with trauma, they present with depression, they're often covered in bruises, they're often feeling suicidal, they're often on the verge of being killed themselves, their children being subject to physical and mental abuse. We've had migrant women who've walked to our centre from, you know, the other side of London because they have no money and it takes them hours to get to our organisation. And that's when, you know, the difficulties really start, because what do we do with these women? They're not entitled to local authority housing. They're not entitled to refuge accommodation because they're not entitled to welfare benefits for that refuge accommodation. So I have a story of a woman who came, was married in India, and it's a lockdown story actually, but it just shows how the lockdown situation exacerbates and amplifies the kind of abuse and oppression that women find themselves in. So she came to the UK in 2017 on a spousal visa. So she was married to her husband and he sponsored her here as his wife. And after arriving here, as is the case so often with many women from South Asian backgrounds, she stayed with her husband and his family. And all of them were subjecting her to verbal abuse, physical abuse, constantly putting her down. Her husband had a very dominant personality and he was also alcoholic. So he would drink a lot and he was very violent to her when he drank. Her mother-in-law and also was perpetrating violence. So she was in a household of multiple perpetrators. And her mother-in-law would often say it was her destiny to be in that house and to be subject to that level of abuse. Her husband wasn't working, partly because of COVID, the COVID pandemic. And so he had real problems also because of his drink, staying in employment. And the lockdown, she said, made it a lot worse because her husband's business opportunity suffered and he started drinking a lot more and he became even more aggressive towards her. She'd say, I often thought about leaving the home, but I didn't know where to go. She said, I had no clue about social organizations in the UK as I came from abroad. And she said she couldn't return to India because she would suffer abuse from her family for having disgraced them for leaving her marriage. She said she suffered a lot of abuse during lockdown, but things went completely out of control and impossible when during lockdown. Eventually she left and she arrived at our door in absolute tears and she had no money. So our job was to really, really try and to find somewhere for her to stay. And that requires us using our own crisis funding that we scrambled together over the years to support women who have nowhere else to go, put them up in usually bed and breakfast, which are not ideal places for women because unlike refuges, there's no support. They're often substandard accommodation. The conditions are not great. But they have to stay in that because we have no alternative. Yeah. So, I mean, her account is one of many, many accounts of the women that we've supported over the years who, because of their lack of immigration status, just simply don't have the options available to other women. And I have to tell you that a lot of these women are qualified. They could contribute. They could be productive members of society. One of the women that's currently in this kind of situation is a health assistant. She could actually be working in a hospital if her situation was more stable, contributing to the fight back during this pandemic. I mean, that's what we're talking about. It just economically, morally, politically, legally makes no sense.
If I can, I'll just talk about in general that victims of domestic abuse have different help seeking journeys. There isn't one experience of domestic abuse. And I think we must, with this bill and with the accompanying guidance, really respect that. There isn't one size fits all when it comes to supporting domestic abuse victims. And I think it's really important that this bill acknowledges the value of our very expert specialist domestic abuse support services. We have a number of specialist by and for, so that's organisations that are run by and for Black and minoritised women, by and for disabled women and LGBT services. And we really must protect those places because they are often the places that victims of domestic abuse will self-refer to. And because they provide that very tailored, specific support that they need. And I think we don't fully have a bill that can ensure the sustainability of that specialist support. We absolutely need to Nicole's point, ensure the funding is there to support the network of refuges, to support the really valuable community-based services that include a wide range of different support, including perpetrators programs, also working on the prevention side. And that's really my concern, that the bill perhaps isn't fully resourcing and appreciating that very specialist support that will serve all survivors in their journey to seeking help.
Hugh, just going to briefly come to you as you listen to that.
What has really come through the stories that has been shared so far is the absolute lack of any form of support that such women experience. And in the end, many women will have to rely on the support from communities, from faith leaders, from community leaders. And depending on, you know, how lucky you are, you may get somebody in the community who totally understands the need for safety and support. Or if you're very unlucky, you may end up with somebody who will exacerbate the abuse, re-victimize you, or send you back to that situation. What's really important during the pandemic has been the recognition that communities and the potential that community leaders and faith leaders have in highlighting and centering the need of survivors and holding perpetrators to account. And that's why, as part of the Faith and Vault Coalition, we have been involved in a campaign to speak to faith leaders and faith communities to say, you have a duty to support survivors, and you have a role to play. And it is vitally important that in your interactions with your communities, whether online, whether on WhatsApp, whether Zoom, you must be asking about what are we doing for survivors and how do we show up for them? And also highlighting the need that actually the most vulnerable have nowhere else to turn but your local community center or your local church, because at the end of the day, that is where where communities step in when the state decides that it has no role to play. It is absolutely vital that society and communities as a whole come together to recognise that they have a role to play.
Thank you, Hugh. And that leads you very nicely. I want to come back to Robin, because obviously in Australia, there is this national framework. Could you just give those listening just a little sense of a picture of what would that look like, following on from what Huda said about the responsibility of whole communities, which is what you're focusing on in Australia? What might a national framework look like?
So the national framework here is based on the international research that people working in the sector will be familiar with about what creates the social context for this to be such a problem and why is this happening at such high rates. So it's based on the understanding, what we know from the evidence, that it's in a context of gender inequality and different intersecting inequalities, but that the national framework in Australia looks at four particular what they call drivers or social enablers, and it seeks to really address the norms and the attitudes, the behaviours and structures linked to them. So to give an example, one of them is disrespect towards women in male peer relations. One of them is male dominated control of resources and decision making. There's one on gender stereotypes, one on condoning violence against women. And what the framework does is it takes, as Huda has been saying, this whole of community approach, whole of society approach, saying we shape this culture together, we all have a role to play in shifting it. And we need change. The change that we need to see is so big that it can only be achieved by all of us working together. So the framework identifies key settings across society, including universities, schools, faith-based organisations, sports clubs, media, and it's trying to engage different settings across society to do some self-reflection on what are the norms that we're reinforcing, what are the attitudes that we're kind of supporting directly, indirectly, looking at their structures and trying to make changes across those different things. And so there's been some huge programs in schools looking at this, with sports clubs, with high profile sports people. I'm working in the faith-based part of that. And it's been really refreshing to and inspiring to see what happens when you take that research seriously that we know about, and you actually really invest in it, and you say, actually, it's not enough to keep responding. We have to keep responding and supporting women, but if we're really serious about them never experiencing this, we have to have a conversation about our culture and what's driving this, and how we can really contribute to that shift.
Thank you, Robin. And I really hope one of the things we will do in the coming months is say, what can we learn from Australia? And Nicole, I hope we can have some further conversations about that. Katie.
Thank you. Yes. I mean, I do just want to really echo what I've heard from others about how fundamental the financial investment in support and responding is here. And I was really struck, I'm going to really take away Nicole's point about how everyone would be surprised at how we don't have a firm foundation for dealing with this. I mean, that really is the basic starting point, which of course the bill doesn't in itself address, apart from the commitment to the refuge provision. And also to really echo the points around migrant women, which when women are criminalised becomes even more acute of a problem. And really, it's so desperately needed for there to be serious principled cross-government work between the Home Office and the Ministry of Justice to start with, Department of Education as well, and social care, to really take responsibility for making sure that those vulnerable migrant women are protected and that they're not subject to threats of deportation when they find themselves driven into offending because of vulnerabilities which are beyond their control. And I've met many women, migrant women, who have been driven into offending, who have lost their children to the care system, who find themselves under threat of deportation. And it is incredibly difficult for support services to work with these women because there are so few options available to them. The luckiest ones find South or Black Sisters or the Nelson Trust and so on. And just briefly to add that there is no effective legal defence in law at the moment in this country where victims of domestic abuse offend directly as a result of their experience of that abuse. The case of Sally Challen, whose appeal last year led to the overturning of her murder conviction to a manslaughter conviction, was a really high profile and quite unusual example of where actually the criminal justice system eventually did take full account of the coercive control she had lived under for so many years and reflected that in the judgment on what she had done in killing her husband. And actually, domestic abuse drives a complete range of offending by victims, mostly women, from shoplifting for somebody who has insufficient means because they're under control from an abuser, to handling stolen goods because they're under direct threat of violence, to use of force against an abuser, which we've heard about. And at the moment, there is no effective defence for those offences. So this is a huge gap in the bill, which there is still time for the government to take the opportunity to address by amending the bill to add statutory defences.
Thank you, Katie, and thank you as well for reminding us that this is going to take serious cross-department working for us to really embed this. And that takes us back to what Robin was saying from Australia about this whole society, whole culture approach. I'm going to give the last word to Nicole. Nicole, one thing I know that people listening to this will say is that we've spoken about women and girls, and there will be people saying, how about domestic abuse that affects men and boys? And I wonder if you might just comment on that before any final remarks, and then I will conclude.
Right, thank you. I'm glad you mentioned it, because I would imagine you're right. People will be listening and thinking that very question. And I would just want to reassure them that my office is representing all people who are subject to domestic abuse. So that would be men, women, children, the whole range and the kind of work of my office in terms of mapping of services, thematic reviews, all of the work going forward, we'll have that in mind, certainly. So I just want people to know that. I think also, though, it is important to say that the vast majority of domestic abuse, the most severe domestic abuse very often is subject to women, or women are victims or survivors. If we think of our homicide reviews, the vast majority, for example, of victims are women. But that's obviously not to say that there is not attention and need to look at all people who are subject to domestic abuse.
Anything that you would want to add, Nicole, as we hope and pray this comes to the Lord soon?
Thank you. Well, I would just say thank you to you, Bishop Rachel, for all you're doing, and other members of the House of Lords who are really getting into the detail of this bill and will be really bringing forth some of these arguments in debating the next stages of the bill. It's really important what you're doing. It's important for listeners to know the role they can play individually, helping friends, family, their own networks, and just knowing about services, understanding that this is a really key point to intervene and really show your support for some of the things that we're talking about. And just saying we have a lot of hope for the future. There's a lot of hope in the progress we can make and will make, and definitely want to encourage listeners to share this podcast, ask other people to listen to it, ask other people to act, think of people who you know will be interested in this issue, because it affects so many people, well over 2 million people just here in the UK last year alone. So it's a huge problem, and it's something that we really need to come together and do something about. And now is the time. So that's just what I would want people to know.
Thank you, Nicole. And it is a real privilege to serve in the House of Lords. And I am looking forward to adding my voice into this very, very important sphere of our life together. And it's important for me as a Christian who believes wholeheartedly in God's desire for all people to flourish. So I'm hoping this bill will come to the Lords soon. I just want to finish by saying a huge thank you to all of you as I look out there and just see the inspiring work you are each involved with. And that's replicated across your organisations, other organisations, and many people across our community. So huge thank you. And I look forward to speaking to you all again soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.